If you need an outline, Brother Spott will brought them with him, and he'll hand them out as he comes back. If you wave to him, he'll give you one. All right. We're coming back to the book of Esther this evening. Mostly the seventh chapter, although I'm going to pick up, I'm going to snag the last verse of chapter 6 one more time. We looked at that last week, but it's a good transition. We've seen, I'm not going to recap everything that's gone before, but, you know, Haman, kind of in a classic counting of one's proverbial chickens before they hatch, Haman had gone home, all excited because he'd had dinner with the king and queen, and he gets to go again tomorrow, okay? And you know what happened? He ran across Mordecai, got all depressed and upset because Mordecai didn't tremble at his presence. And anyway, we found out that he stayed up all night building a scaffold upon which to have a scaffold or a gallows upon which to have Mordecai impaled the next day, and showed up at the palace first thing in the morning to make his pitch before the king so he could get Mordecai out of the way and enjoy dinner again tonight with the second banquet with the queen to which he had been invited. But we also saw last week that the king had been up all night too. It's a little bit ironic, but providentially so, that the king decided to put his wakefulness to some use instead of being busy building a scaffold on which to execute Mordecai. He was reading, or having read to him, the records of current events, or past events, I should say, that might need some of his attention. Of course, by sheer coincidence, the reader just happened to turn to a foiled assassination plot, the record of a foiled assassination plot that Mordecai, who sat at the gate, had happened to discover and report and have investigated and saved the king's life. And the king said, you know, what did we ever do about that? He said, nothing was ever done for him, king. So the king says, we need to do something about that. As I said last week, I speculated possibly this was all, obviously it was by God's direction, whether he did it simply by the random chance of this reader turning to that passage in the king's chronicles, or whether this was a man who might have been sympathetic to Mordecai and found himself in a providentially provided opportunity to intervene in all this stuff going on between Mordecai and Haman. There's reason to suspect that the events about which he was reading were as much as 4 or 5 years old by the time he's reading that account. We don't know for sure when that happened, but we're told of the foiled plot at the end of chapter 2, and we know that that was in the 5th year of King Ahasuerus, and we're now in the 7th year, and we're now in the 12th. So somewhere in there is when that happened, probably to the earlier side of that is what is generally presumed. What we do know is that we've kind of picked up a little bit on reading between the lines here in the scuttlebutt within the court. We kind of get a picture of we see some evidence at least that Mordecai and Esther were beloved at court. They were widely respected. Esther had a staff that loved her and fasted with her. Mordecai had people that were not entirely throwing him under the bus when he wasn't bowing before Haman. And it also looks like Haman was probably beloved by virtually no one. Even those that are his friends and his wife don't seem to be particularly loving and supportive when everything that transpires actually transpires. We haven't all gotten to there yet entirely. Whatever means God used to guide this reader to this particular passage in the records, the king, Xerxes, or Ahasuerus, as he's called here in this text, decided to reward Mordecai, and as he made that decision, Haman showed up early to ask permission to have Mordecai executed. And so the king calls Haman in, and it's possible that Ahasuerus was just as clueless about the interactions of the people of his court as he sometimes seems. But as I mentioned last week, I'm a little suspicious that he was aware that of at least some of Haman's animosity toward Mordecai, and he recognized that Mordecai was a guy. He's just discovered Mordecai as a man who's earned a reward, and probably is more than a little suspicious of Haman's ambition and the potential threat that he might represent to the crown. It's so typical for a king to, I mean, it's not at all unusual to see kings assassinated and someone else rise to take their place. Usually the assassin is someone close to him. And that's all kinds of historic records of that in every kingdom. Don't have to go back but two generations to see that in the Persian kingdom. So he probably saw Haman as a man who needed a little humbling. So before Haman could state his business, whether I'm reading too much into that or not, I don't know. But before Haman could state his business, the king asked Haman to recommend a way for the king to reward a man that was especially deserving of honor. And Haman immediately leaped to the assumption that he was talking about him, the text tells us. And so he quickly outlined a public spectacle for showing the king's favor, that special parade on the king's horse and so on. And the king approved and said, okay, Haman, you go do everything you just said to Mordecai. Right? And I just loved to have been a fly on the wall just to look at Haman's face when he was given those instructions. He did it. He followed. He carried out what the king commanded because there was a threat included in that command. Went home in utter humiliation, told his friends and his wife, and they cynically announced, you're doomed. Okay, that if you've gone up against Mordecai, he's a Jew, it's over for you. That's why I tell you that I'm not sure they loved him much either. Now, because the last verse, I call that Haman's hope, the last verse of chapter 6, introduces the action of chapter 7. I've snagged that and included it in our outline for tonight, and we'll pick up with that in just a moment. Let's start now with prayer. Father, we ask that you would bless as we examine this portion of your word tonight, that we will be able to kind of get a feel for what's really going on there. There's this historic event that we will sense some of what they were thinking and feeling and be able to appreciate the action, but also to see what you were doing in defense of your people and learn some of the lessons that you have for us from this passage tonight. In Jesus' name, amen. Well, Haman has had this awful day, and right at the end, I'm maybe guessing that he interpreted this as hope. At least the queen still wanted him to come to dinner. The king sends his people to get him. So I called it Haman's hope. The king's eunuchs come to escort him to the dinner. Says hastily. I don't think that implies he had forgotten or that he was about to be late. I think it simply means that the king sent somebody to bring him when it was time and got to get him there quickly, and he didn't want to keep the queen waiting. And so he was taken then to Esther's banquet. Now, with everything that's going on today, and knowing we, the readers, know what favor Esther's going to ask the king, and so we can't help but anticipate a very interesting dinner. Even if we haven't read ahead in this. So we get to the opening of chapter 7, and we read Ahasuerus' pledge. The king, it says, now the king and Haman came to drink wine with Esther the queen. And the king said to Esther on the second day, also as they drank their wine at the banquet, what is your petition, Queen Esther? It shall be granted you. And what is your request? Even to half of the kingdom, it shall be done. Now, the expression on, let me back up. And when we were in chapter 1, I explained how much of Persia's social and political interaction centered around drinking copious amounts of wine, and how the Persians were renowned worldwide for their capacity to absorb alcoholic beverage. The kings drank, they drank till they were drunk, then they'd make decisions, then the next day when they were sober, or a couple days later when they were sober, they would examine them and then decide whether or not they were going to stand. Sometimes they'd do the reverse. Herodotus, the Greek historian, mocked the Persians for their reliance upon drinking. Now, the King James says that they came to the banquet with Esther the queen, I think is how they translate that word. And in general English usage, the word banquet emphasizes abundant food rather than drink. But this is a word for beverages, for consuming beverages, to drink. The New American Standard supplies the word wine because we know later that's the beverage they were consuming. But they were having drinks with the queen that night. That's literally what this text says. Whether dinner was also being served or it was already been served and the drinks came after dinner, or whether the evening began with drinking and they never got to the meal, the text doesn't tell us. But they were there to drink. In letter A, that's what the text says they had come to do. Now it says on the second day. Some have thought that this was a 2-day banquet or something, and the king didn't ask Esther what she wanted until the second day. But that's completely unnecessary interpretation of that. It's just that this is the second banquet. She had one yesterday. He said, "I'll tell you what." The king said, "Tell me what your request is." He says, "I'll tell you tomorrow. Come tomorrow too." And well, it's tomorrow. It's the second day. That's I think the only thing this means. They had joined her for a similar banquet yesterday. Well, they're now here. They know the king is intensely curious what request the queen could make that was worth risking her life to interrupt him at court, and then to invite him to not one time but twice to dine, and to have invited Haman to come along as well. Evidently, it has something to do with affairs at court. It's not a personal matter, is what he's going to be assuming, at least. They may have chatted politely through the meal, and then the king raised this question in the drinks with drinks afterward, or he may have jumped right to the point as the first drinks were served on this second day, which is what I suspect happened. I just don't know. I think the shift in form of address is interesting. It's worth noticing. The narrator tells us the king asked Esther to tell him what he wanted. In verse 2, the king said to Esther on the second day. But when he actually quotes the king, in the words he uses to quote the king doesn't call her Esther. He calls her Queen Esther. I think that's significant. He asks, "What is your petition, Queen Esther?" And for the rest of the chapter, her name is always preceded by her title, with only one exception, and that's in verse 6. And I'll mention that when we get there. It's Queen Esther for the rest of the chapter. I think that the narrator is providing an account of events in the life. This whole account is dealing with events in the life of a Jewess named Esther. But on this night, it's important that we remember she's not just one of the king's many wives, and she's not just a Jewess who happens to be in a key socio-political position. She is queen, and the king acknowledges her as his queen consistently. I don't think Haman immediately picked up on this, and I doubt if he noticed or considered its importance yet, because he doesn't know what's coming. But when she reveals her request, it's going to be blindingly obvious that the king all evening has been emphasizing the huge gulf between his position and hers. Just how much the king values her over him, as he's consistently calling her Queen Esther. He's treating her as queen. He is talking to her as queen. He is dealing with this as an official legal transaction, when he is going to grant her the request that she files before him. And Haman, I think, picks up on the significance of that as the evening develops. The king asks her, "What is your petition and what is your request?" using two different words that are almost synonymous. Esther will use exactly the same two words in exactly the same order when she responds and tells him what her petition is and what is her request. And again, I think this probably indicates the formality of the proceedings. What we're seeing here is a process by which her making this formal request to the king and the king granting her this request is a legally binding transaction. And Haman is there as witness to hold the king to it, if nothing else. He's there as witness. That's the way all of them are reading this. That's how this is. I think that's implied in the way all of this is worded, in the way this whole thing is handled. It's an official royal action. Haman will provide the testimony as witness to this. To sign a document, if necessary, is the idea. And he then repeats this incredibly broad promise that he had made to her before. He pledged to give her whatever she asked, up to half the kingdom. Now, again, I said this is probably hyperbole, that he's not likely to section off half the kingdom and deed it to her as a result of a request. But the point is that it's difficult to imagine anything that she might ask that would exceed his willingness to be generous and to give her what she wants, and which is the whole point. I'm sure Haman is more than just a little curious. He's assuming she showed him great honor in asking him to come as witness to this whole proceedings, because his presence is going to be an important aspect of the binding nature of the request she's making and the pledge the king makes in response. Boy, is he about to be surprised. Okay. Esther's response when the king repeats that, he says, okay, what is it? Why are we here? Tell me your petition. Tell me your request. I'll give you anything you ask, up to half of the kingdom. Well, she began very humbly and respectfully, as we see in this next. Did I give you what the second or third Roman numeral, Esther's response? She stated her request in verses 3 and 4. And again, note that this is the request that comes from Queen Esther. Queen Esther replied, and humbly, respectfully, if I have found favor in your sight, O king, and if it pleases the king. And again, this seems to be a formula, a formulaic way of addressing the king. And then she gets right to the point. Let my life be given me as my petition, and my people as my request. She asked for her life as her petition and her people as her request. And I kind of, again, I'm trying to envision this as like that proverbial fly on the wall and reading people's expressions. And I imagine the king looking more than a little puzzled or perplexed. Who would dare threaten the life of the queen and her people? And I think by people, he probably assumes she means her extended family. I think Haman's probably looking a little surprised, but probably starting to feel a little queasy. Okay. Maybe wishing he hadn't eaten that last shrimp or whatever with the meal, because he's probably going just a little pale. And the queen goes on to explain why she had to make such a request. She said, we have been sold. We have been sold. Now, our minds immediately go back to the remembrance of that deal that Haman made with the king to have permission to annihilate a particular people that were troubling and that were causing you problems in the kingdom. They're going to cause problems for everybody. But I'll tell you what, you let me get rid of them and you'll get, remember the amount is 375 tons of gold that will come into your coffers, all right? We have been sold. Now, I don't think the king still understands what she's talking about. But I think Haman is probably getting even more queasy. As this is coming a little closer and closer to what he had no reason to fear before he showed up. I don't think he knows for sure he's doomed until the next words leave the queen's mouth. Not only did she say, we have been sold, I and my people, to be destroyed, to be killed, and to be annihilated. Does that sound familiar? She's quoting the edict Haman wrote, decreeing that the Jews are to be sold, to be killed, or to be destroyed, to be killed, and to be annihilated. He used exactly those three verbs in the edict, which is you know, kind of redundant when you think about it, but he wants to be thorough. So here Esther is now quoting them, and Haman, it's beginning to dawn on Haman. The queen is Jewish. Okay, what have I done? Right, it's beginning to dawn on him. That edict that Haman wrote, if you recall, not the king, that Haman signed with the king's signet, not the king, and that the king had evidently never read. Haman had never told him what people group he wanted to have annihilated. I suspect the king, even if he probably knows, he probably doesn't know that Esther is a Jew, but I don't think he cares. He knew Mordecai was a Jew. When he honored him, he called him Mordecai the Jew when he told Haman to go and give him that special honor earlier this morning, right? So I think the king is still a little oblivious to this. He's not been much of a hands-on guy in dealing with this situation, but he's still not looking at Haman when she says this. He hasn't wrote. There's no evidence that when she says that he's looking. That's what you wrote, right? As if he's accusing Haman of this. Haman, I think, is evidently paralyzed, recognizing that this day is going to end worse than it started, which is kind of difficult for him to imagine right now. Esther goes on to explain something interesting. As she said, "We have been sold, I and my people, to be destroyed, to be killed, and to be annihilated. Now, if we had only been sold as slaves, men and women, I would have remained silent, for the trouble would not be commensurate with the annoyance to the king." Now, I need to tell you this, that the word translated annoyance is the key to this verse and understanding what this means. But several linguists say that this, the second half of this verse, is the toughest portion of this entire book to translate. And the reason is the word translated annoyance is a unique word. This is the only time it shows up anywhere in the Hebrew literature, scripture or otherwise. This word doesn't show up anywhere else in Hebrew literature. I'm not an expert in Hebrew literature, but that's what I'm told by those who are. And so exactly how this should be translated is open to some question. Different translations handle it slightly different ways. The NET Bible reads, "troubling." It's not worth troubling the king. The Holman Christian Standard, "burdening the king." And what all those translators, including the translators of the New American Standard, assume is that what Esther must have meant is that had myself and my people been merely sold as slaves, we would have been willing to accept slavery rather than bothering such an august personage as yourself, the king, because it's too petty to trouble you about that. Had it not been the fact that our lives are threatened, we've been sold for genocide, I would have left you alone because we would have been willing to accept slavery as not rising to the degree of bothering you with it. I'm not sure that's what she means. That may be what she means. That's how it's translated here. The King James helps a little bit. I think they come a little closer with their translation of the word. They're more likely. It says the way they translate it is damage. But in the King James, the sentence structure is awkward enough. It's kind of hard to figure out what the translators mean by the sentence there, that she wouldn't have mentioned it because of the damage. The English Standard offers a solution that is I think, probably helpful. Maybe I think it's probably closer to the actual meaning here. The English Standard says, "If we had been sold merely as slaves, men and women, I would have been silent, for our affliction is not to be compared with the loss to the king." Not to be compared with the loss to the king. Now, what loss could she be talking about? Well, if the king is to rescue her and her people, what does he lose? 375 tons of silver. And she's saying, look, it may be that what she means is she wouldn't have asked the king to purchase them from slavery, to purchase their liberty for 375 tons of silver. Because I think that that's probably more than you'd have been willing to pay for it. That may be what she means. That's what the translators of the English Standard Version assume. He hasn't yet realized he's going to forfeit that amount if he grants her request, because he hadn't yet put together that she's Jewish and she's talking about the edict Haman signed. He hadn't put that together yet. There's another possibility. The NIV suggests an alternative translation in the margin of the New International Version, and it says, "The compensation our adversary offers cannot be compared with the loss the king would suffer." That makes some sense too, that what she's saying is she may be appealing to the king's self-interest and may mean that their deaths, if he lets this go through, their deaths will end up costing the king more than the enemy was willing to pay him, than the enemy was paying him. You know that 375 tons of silver he's offered for you if you have us annihilated? you haven't done the cost-benefit analysis, O king. And you haven't considered the cost to the kingdom to have the entire Jewish population annihilated. Not just in future taxes, but also in productivity. What's the long-term cost to the kingdom? Your goal is too short-sighted. Had we merely been sold as slaves, the cost-benefit analysis wouldn't have been nearly as far in our favor. But as it is, if we're annihilated, it's going to cost you way more than what Haman's promised. Now, she hasn't articulated it in those details yet because he still knows she's talking about Haman. And he still doesn't realize she's talking about that amount of 375 tons of silver. But the immediate profit, equal to 2/3 of a year's income for the empire, is a short-sighted gain when you consider the downside of the loss of the Jewish people in the kingdom throughout the empire. So either one of those, I think, are preferable to this, well, I'd rather been a slave than bother you with this. I suspect that's not what she means, although that's the way it's rendered here. Anyway, it's a tricky verse to translate, and precisely what she means is open to some question. Any one of those three are possible. All right. Well, the king, Ahasuerus, asked Queen Esther to identify the enemy, and the way it's worded here is a little bit anemic, frankly. Who is he, and where is he, who would presume to do thus? Adam Clark says that the Hebrew here is abrupt and choppy. He provides a literal translation that he punctuates with frequent dashes to kind of get a feel for a king who is absolutely boiling over with fury. This is Adam Clark's. I'll try to read it the way his punctuation implies it should be read. That when she says that we have been sold to be destroyed and killed and annihilated, he says, who, he, this one, and where, this one, he, who, he to fill his heart to do thus? It's like he's almost incoherent. He's babbling in rage. Try to smooth that out. The translators simply say, who is he, and where is he who would presume to do thus? But he's about to come unglued. Where is such a man who would presume to do such an outrageous thing? And in fury, he demanded the king's identity. In fury, the king demanded the enemy's identity. Esther, this time without queen, the one time here after the first verse that she's not called Queen Esther, I think this time to emphasize her role as a Jewess, because of who she is under this law, is going to have them annihilated. She uses two words that are virtual synonyms for an adversary. One's translated foe and one's translated enemy. The word translated foe means one who afflicts or who causes injury. The one translated enemy means one who hates or who despises. The one who would hurt us and the one who hates us. The foe, the enemy, and in one of the more dramatic moments in all of Scripture, one that we've anticipated for a long time as readers, I kind of imagine her flinging her arm out and saying, it is this wicked Haman. Don't know what looks on his face right now. It's probably pretty pale, whatever expression it may be. This wicked Haman, she identified as her adversary. Well, I've listed, for number four, I've called it the guest's reactions. Verse 6b, then Haman became terrified. All right, this is much worse than anything that had ever happened to him before or that he ever imagined could possibly happen to him. In another context, in some other context or some other setting, or if the day had gone differently, we might have expected him to try to bluster his way out of this, casting aspersions on Esther. Had she told this to the king when Haman wasn't present and the king went to confront Haman and Haman tries to lie his way out of it or to manipulate his way out of it, I don't know. But what, you know, he's already had a really horrible day. And the king knows that Mordecai's a Jew. He didn't know the Jews were the people Haman had planned to target for genocide. And just this morning, the king had honored Mordecai for having saved the king's life, probably knew how deeply it would humiliate Haman to have to do that. Haman has just witnessed the king's high regard for Esther, consistently calling her queen, and heard him pledge again to give her anything she asked for up to half the kingdom in a formal statement of a promise. And then it's little wonder that he is absolutely terrified because he knows the binding nature of the pledge the king has just made. And the king, Haman's terrified. The king is so furious he stormed out. He left. Now, he didn't go far. All right. The king arose in his anger from drinking wine and went into the palace garden. Now, surely there were servants in the room pouring drinks, serving food, probably some secret service type bodyguards that accompanied them to this banquet. There's no way the king would storm out and leave Esther alone with Haman in this setting. So there are others, and we'll find out that were in just a moment. But he left. He left the room. He had to get a breath of air. He went out to the palace gardens, I think, probably to collect his thoughts. He had some tough decisions to make. I mean, he himself had approved this decree. Now what's he going to do? Haman was a talented individual. He'd become important to the king as an advisor. If the king makes a move against Haman, what sort of long-term problems is that going to create for him? There's also the problem of the unalterable law of the Medes and Persians. What's he going to do about this? He's already signed this decree, and it's been publicized in his name. He had approved the decree to annihilate every member of this particular ethnic group. He had no idea it was his wife's, his queen's ethnic group, and Mordecai's. He's sworn now, tonight, to rescue her and her people. So how does he get around this unchangeable law? And what does he do about this rascal Haman? I mean, Haman's still wearing the king's signet ring. I doubt if he resolved all these dilemmas during one lap around the palace garden. But while he is out, Haman makes an appeal to the queen. Haman stayed to beg for his life from Queen Esther. He didn't follow the king to try to beg for his life from the king. He stayed to beg Esther for his life, for he saw that harm had been determined against him by the king. That's kind of a bland way of putting it, I think, at this point. It wouldn't have taken a clairvoyant to recognize the king's mood and the king's intent at this point. Now, I don't know how to envision this event. Haman might have leaned down toward Queen Esther on her couch where she reclined for the meal and fallen atop her. Rabbinical literature offers a rather fanciful description. The rabbis claim that the angel Gabriel pushed him onto her. okay, they kind of bring Gabriel into this when the text says nothing about him, but because they consider this a divinely appointed outcome, and they're right about that. So they claim that the angel Gabriel pushed him. Another suggestion might be that some have said that he was kneeling before her, grasping at her feet and ankles, kissing them in supplication. That tableau is maybe a little appealing when you consider the irony of it, when he was the guy who was so angry that Mordecai wouldn't bow before him. And now here he is, perhaps grasping the feet of this Jewess and kissing them and asking for his life from her. Maybe that's what it was. All we're told is that he begged for his life. Whatever happened, it happened fast, and the king walked in while it's going on. He came back, and Ahasuerus misinterpreted what he saw. Haman was not assaulting the queen, but that's what it looked like to the king. That's how he interpreted it. The word translated assault has just about as wide a range of meanings as the English word assault. It could have been any one of a number of things that could have been going on that the king might have thought could have been happening. Some have said that the king thought he was trying to rape the queen. That's a part of what that word might mean. Others have said the king thought Haman was trying to murder the queen. That's another possible meaning of the word. It's interesting that under Persian law, the penalty for rape and for murder were identical. Death by impaling. A little bit of irony there, right? I don't know what the king thought. I can't help but wonder if the king really thought either of those were going on. But he saw Haman approach the queen, falling upon her, kneeling before her, whatever it was. And he came in and just said, looks like he's assaulting the queen. All right. Haman may have given him the answer he needed on what to do with this rascal. Because now he's got witnesses that heard the king assume he was assaulting the queen, and the penalty for what the king said he saw is death by impaling. Here's a political spin to a situation, if you will, that he has now the political excuse to remove him without having to say anything about how he had manipulated me into signing that thing, that edict. So king can save face and get rid of this guy at the same time. Now, whether he misinterpreted it on purpose or whether, I don't know. I don't know. There are some who accuse Esther of being cold-hearted because she didn't explain, no, Haman wasn't hurting me. He just was begging for my help. You could argue on one hand that Haman's evil plan to annihilate all the Jews, including the queen, was reason enough for her to let the king think whatever he wanted about this scene and just deal with it as he chose. It's also possible that the king is going to use this as a convenient excuse, as I mentioned, but I think perhaps more importantly, we got to remember who these people are. He's the Persian king, and I don't know if you've noticed, but throughout this narrative, every time Esther has spoken, and she's only spoken to the king, nobody has spoken to the king until the king speaks to them first. I'm not sure Esther was at liberty to speak unless the king asked. He came to the dinner, and she didn't tell him her request until he said, "Tell me your request." When she came to see him at court, she didn't say a word until he said, "Why are you here?" When he came to the first dinner, she didn't say a word until he said, "What is your request?" There's no record. Now, I'm not sure that's the case, but it seems to me that we've got a situation where he's king and nobody speaks till he gives him permission. He's furious. He comes back. He sees this. And let's see, where are we? Verse 8, the king returned from the palace garden into the place where they were drinking wine. Haman was falling on the couch where Esther was. Then the king said, "Will he even assault the queen with me in the house?" As the word went out of the king's mouth, they covered Haman's face. So we have this, Roman number 5 is Ahasuerus' decree. And I don't think we should accuse Esther of cold-heartedness when she doesn't speak up in Haman's defense. A lot of reasons why she wouldn't have needed to do so. Now, when it says at the beginning of, or at the end of this verse, as the word went out of the king's mouth, many assume that the word there is referring to what he's just said. Is this man going to assault the queen with me in the house? It may be that that's what that word meant, and as soon as the king said that, they covered Haman's face to take him away for execution. If that's the case, then we have to presume that the guards have been trained that if the king makes such a statement, they are to interpret that as a sentence of death. It's also possible at this point that the narrator hasn't quoted the king, that the word that came out of his mouth is something that's not recorded here. And the king just said, "He's guilty, he'll die," whatever decree it might be. Whatever it was, whether it was the presumption because of the accusation of assault or whether it's a specific sentence, either way, it was interpreted as Ahasuerus having pronounced sentence, letter A. The word would have been his sentence. The word the king spoke was a pronouncement of guilt, the sentence of death, which would be by impaling. And now we have evidence that servants are actually there, probably high-ranking ones in the room with them, or perhaps summoned by the commotion, but I think that's unlikely. I think they were probably right there taking, watching, observing, making sure that everything was safe in this august setting. As soon as the king gave the word, they covered his face. Don't know whether they put a sack over his head or took his turban and wrapped his head in it or pulled his cloak up over his face. We don't know. There's nothing in the Persian records that indicate that they typically covered a man's head when they took him away for execution. The Romans did that. The Romans said they learned it from the Greeks. The Greeks said they learned it from the Persians, but there's no evidence in the Persian records that that's the case, that they covered a man's face. We can only guess what they did. I think it's interesting in verse 9, we see a name, Harbona, one of the eunuchs who were before the king. Harbona's name, without the final letter, shows up in the first chapter as one of the king's eunuchs that he went to fetch Vashti the night that he wanted Vashti to come and present herself before his military leaders, and she refused to come. And so it's very, I think it's likely this is the same guy. It's just a few years later, and there's not going to be a whole lot of turnover among the king's staff in a place like this. It's not at all unreasonable to assume he's the same guy that was a part of that, the entourage that has come with the king and the queen for this banquet. I also don't think it's much of a stretch to suggest that this man may have been as loyal to Esther as many of the others of the queen's staff and the servants that the king had appointed to her care. He certainly had had some contact or some authority over the king's harem and the queen because he was sent on an errand to fetch Queen Vashti. And so there would have been some kind of a relationship. He certainly knew her quite well and probably was aware of the relationship with Mordecai. We forget that these people are all part of a rather small community of people that live at court and function at court. And they're aware of all of this stuff, all the stuff going on, and they're more aware of the undercurrent and tensions and animosities and things than maybe the king would even be. But I think it's interesting that Harbona, who's one of the eunuchs, who was probably one of the ones who was responsible for communicating with at least Esther and supervising her as the queen, said, "Behold, indeed, the gallows standing at Haman's house, 50 cubits high, which Haman made for Mordecai, the guy who spoke good on the king's behalf." Said, "O king, basically, in case you're interested, there's a spike already erected. Haman built it last night. It's 75 feet tall. He planned to execute Mordecai on it this morning." You know, the guy you had him proclaim around, run around the parade ground telling everybody what a great guy he was. "Just so you know, there's one there. It'd be a shame to let a structure like that go to waste." I think you get just a hint of how the guys at court viewed Haman and Mordecai and Esther. The king, so what I put here in the outline is Harbona recommended an ironically appropriate location for execution. Oh, okay. I mean, it happens to be in Haman's backyard, but it's handy. It's right there, just outside the wall of the citadel. And the king's response was very simple and straightforward. "Hang him on it," he said. Haman then, we are told, was impaled on the spike he had erected for Mordecai. So they hanged Haman on the gallows, which he had prepared for Mordecai, and the king's anger subsided. Second time that word has appeared, the word translated subsided or abated in the King James, second time in the Old Testament that word has appeared. You know when the first time was? Genesis chapter 8, when the waters of the flood abated or subsided, gives you some view of the towering fury of the king when his anger is compared with the flood waters of the deluge by the use of that word here. The king's anger was abated. Nevertheless, the king still has a dilemma to resolve. How's he going to get around that edict that he signed, that Haman signed in his name? That's the subject of the next chapter. Four lessons. We'll wrap this up tonight. First of all, rarely do we see anywhere a more dramatic example of how evil schemes can trap the schemer. Three passages from Proverbs that I've cited here, Proverbs 11:6, the righteousness of the upright will deliver them, but the treacherous will be caught by their own greed. Proverbs 26:27, he who digs a pit will fall into it. He who rolls a stone, it will come back on him. Proverbs 29:16, when the wicked increase, transgression increases, but the righteous will see their fall. As hard to imagine a much more dramatic example of how evil schemes end up trapping the schemer, as it has Mordecai. Another lesson that we see from this is how quickly destruction and adversity can overwhelm a person quickly. All of a sudden, I mean, things were going great for Haman until yesterday. I mean, this morning, everything was fine yesterday. He went home ecstatic that he was going back for a second banquet with the king and queen. What a day. This dramatic turnaround. I'm reminded of what Paul says in 1 Thessalonians chapter 5, verse 3. He says, while they are saying peace and safety, then destruction will come upon them suddenly like labor pains upon a woman with child, and they will not escape. What's Paul talking about? He's talking about what's going to happen when Christ returns to establish his kingdom and to judge the enemies of God. Is that not what's happening on a small scale right here? There's a small scale example of what God says will happen to his enemies when Christ comes back, and it will come suddenly and totally when he annihilates all those who are his enemies. We have to live with the enemies for now. We have to deal with their enmity. And so on. But there's coming a day when judgment will fall, and it will come suddenly and totally. So they'll be completely removed. That day's coming. It's not yet. But we get a little picture of how destruction and adversity can overwhelm them quickly. And then, there are some character lessons to learn. There are three central characters in this narrative. Mordecai's not one of the central ones in this chapter. But you've got three main characters here. You've got Haman, you've got the king, and you've got Esther. And each one of those, we can learn something from their example. One of the ones from the case of Haman, we see evidence that an arrogant person can be a coward. An arrogant person can be a coward. He was terrified when his arrogance came home to roost, as it were, when his mistakes came home to him. An arrogant person can be a coward. The king illustrates the fact that a powerful person can be manipulated. Here's a man who was arguably the most powerful human being in the world at that time. And he was subject to manipulation by Haman. And he's finally recognized that, at least to a certain degree. He's not sure what to do about it. But even a powerful man can be manipulated. Sometimes by forces of evil, sometimes because the king's heart is in the hand of God, as we will see later. But then something else that we see in Esther. So often, a person who is described as meek or humble or submissive is presumed to be cowardly and weak. That is not Esther. Nothing cowardly or weak about this woman. But she was humble and submissive. So I've said it's number three, a humble person can be courageous and strong. A humble person can be courageous and strong. She was bold, she was brave, she was strong, she was steadfast. She was never brash or offensive. In the face of circumstances with potentially disastrous outcomes, Esther demonstrated incredible courage, incredible strength, and she did it with grace and with poise. A lot to learn from the way Esther behaves herself in this context. But there's one more important lesson that's illustrated here, and I'm not entirely certain that Ahasuerus would have framed it quite this way, but the king himself learned a very important lesson this day, that a godly wife is priceless. A godly wife is priceless. Proverbs 31:10 says her value is far above, well, the King James says rubies. The translation rubies is doubtful. They just took a guess because it's a rare word and they don't know. It's a precious stone of some kind. Her price is far above jewels. In this particular story, it's not jewels that are at stake. It's 375 tons of silver. And Ahasuerus decided that Esther was worth more than that. A godly wife is priceless. Shall we pray? Father, we thank you for your word. We thank you for the lessons that we can learn from the text, from the narrative you've provided.